Welcome to Breaking Green, a podcast by Global Justice Ecology Project. On Breaking Green, we will talk with activists and experts to examine the intertwined issues of social, ecological, and economic injustice. We will also explore some of the more outrageous proposals to address climate and environmental crises that are falsely being sold as green. I am your host, Steve Taylor. Described by some as the blood carbon cop, COP28 paved the way for a massive expansion of carbon credits. Activists claim that the carbon credit market is disastrous for indigenous people and represents a major new way for governments, corporations, and conservation NGOs to profit from the theft of indigenous lands. On this episode of Breaking Green, we will talk with Fiore Longo of Survival International, an organization formed in 1969 to promote the rights of indigenous peoples as contemporary societies with a right to self-determination. Fiore Longo is a campaigner at Survival International, the global movement for tribal peoples, and is the director of Survival International France and Spain. She also coordinates Survival's conservation campaign and has visited many communities in Africa and Asia that face human rights abuses in the name of conservation. Fiore Longo, welcome back to Breaking Green.
Thank you very much.
This is our second interview, so welcome back. We wanted to talk to you this time about Survival International's recent press release. Survival International, Amnesty International, and minority rights groups released a statement in the run-up to COP28 denouncing Kenya's illegal evictions of the Ogiak people. In it, you highlight the role conservation projects and carbon credits play in those land thefts. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yes. Well, as you know, I guess at this point, Survival has been campaigning against evictions in the name of conservation for years. And recently, we started campaigning against evictions in the name of climate mitigation. Unfortunately, what happened to the Ogiek, just for reminder of the audience, the Ogiek had been evicted again. This is nothing new. They have been evicted many times, unfortunately, in their history. But in these new evictions, at least 1,000 Ogiek have lost their houses. Their houses have been burned. Their forest, they have been evicted from their forest, and now they are landless. They don't know where to go. And again, this eviction was in the name of protecting the Mau forest, because the government of Kenya accused the Ogiek of destroying the forest. The Ogiek are hunter-gatherers, and now they're practicing other kind of activities, and they rely on the forest for living, but they do not destroy the forest. The idea that indigenous people destroy their landscapes and their environment is actually completely colonialist and racist. And is this the big idea behind the new push for land in the name of conservation and climate mitigation? We are very worried of what is happening. There is this new massive attack on indigenous lands to find land enough to create projects like for compensating emissions. For example, planting trees that could eventually absorb carbon or protect forests that would avoid the release of carbon. And these activities can produce what it's called carbon credits, and these carbon credits can be sold by multinational corporations to claim that they are net zero. And why we're worried about this? Because the COP28 is the space where the idea of a global carbon market is going to be decided. So what we have now are voluntary carbon markets. So companies can just simply might want to buy carbon credits so they can claim in their websites and to their consumers that they are net zero or they are climate friendly, but there is nothing mandatory. So the signature of this agreement at the COP28, which apparently won't happen this year, could accelerate this process. Multinational corporations want land of indigenous peoples because these are the places that they're best conserved, where there is more biodiversity, and they want it to claim, to offset their emissions. So saying, well, we are protecting this forest, so we don't need to reduce our emissions. So we are very worried about that. We think that what's happening with the Ogiek, these evictions in the name of conservation, is linked to this process. There is no evidence that it has been done for selling carbon credits, and we cannot say that, but we know for sure that they are being evicted for another greenwashing project, apparently linked to a Dutch company. So there is, it's very difficult to understand what's going on now, but what is sure is that Kenya government wants to put itself as the champion in the fight for climate change, which doesn't mean, as we would expect, that this really means that there will be reductions in emissions, but it means that he's opening the country. And he did it with the African summit that he held in September. He wants to open the country to new investors. And these investments are going to be carbon credits. And these carbon credits, and this is important for the people to know, is not just an abstract financial thing that is going around there. To produce this carbon credit, they need land. Land to plant trees or land to protect forests. And those spaces are not empty. There are Kenyan people living there, indigenous people living there, and they are going to be evicted to compensate emissions of the most polluting companies in the world. This is why we are calling this COP, and we are calling actually our campaign Blood Carbon, because these carbon credits that we are exchanging in the market, in the financial market, are actually coming with the blood of the people that are losing their lands and their lives.
Yes, there were some headlines that a Dubai-based firm, Blue Carbon, had signed a framework of collaboration with Kenya State Department for millions of hectares. So the idea is that Kenya will get into the carbon market trading system, and then corporations, and I think you outlined some deals with Netflix and Meta in your report. They'll say, hey, we're offsetting our carbon emissions. We're working towards carbon neutrality. But at the same time, Kenya now is going to be displacing indigenous people. And your report really highlights that this whole notion is probably based on false assumptions, if not outright deceptions. So for example, could you explain maybe what was going on with, in your report, you talk about the Northern Kenyan Grasslands Carbon Project and how that has taken land away from indigenous people and claim that they're going to allow or enforce a type of grazing that is better for carbon capture. So tell us a little bit about that and how that's a false assumption built in there.
Yeah, so just to clarify, the blue carbon stuff, which it's a separate one from the one in Kenya, from the one that we have studied, but it shows how big this new market is going to be. So Blue Carbon is a company that is linked to the royal family of the United Emirates, and they are signing this kind of agreement to allow the company to sell carbon credits with many countries in Africa, for an amount of land in total that is going to be the size of the UK. So that means that these different countries like Tanzania or Kenya or Zimbabwe are giving to this company land enough to produce a carbon credit project. This carbon could also serve, if there was a global market, to the Emirates to say, we don't have to reduce our fossil fuel production, we can just buy this carbon credit. We have been working with my colleague Simon on this project for a long time because we thought it was quite emblematic of what is going to happen in a bigger scale if the carbon credit markets explode in the next years. And why we find it emblematic? Because it has everything that doesn't work with the carbon credit system and shows very well how embedded colonialism, racism are in these markets. So it's a typical typical Western idea in which we found there is a problem, which is the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis, and we think to solve it without looking into the real roots of the problem. That is, of course, our way of living, overconsumption, and exploitation of resource for profit. In the case of Kenya Grassland Project, in the north of Kenya, it's very, as I said, very classic example. So we have a community of different indigenous peoples living in the area, Samburu, Borana, Rendile. And they are pastoralists, so they need they move around with their livestock, with their cows or whatever they have in that moment. Sometimes camels, and they move around searching for rain because when there is rain, there is grass and the animals can eat. Lately, what has been happening is that there is the less and less land available for pastoralists to move. We need to look back in the history. So we are in an area that just a little bit southern, in the south from the area we are talking about, the UK, the royal family, during the colonization, so the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, they have been giving and granting land to different British people. Many of those lands are still in the hands of these British people that today, British families that today are were born generations after generations. These guys have been become Kenyan, and many of these big properties have this root in the colonization. One of these families, the Craig family, created. They have this land that had been given by the crown. Then they became ranchers, so they have ranch. And then when the ranch was not anymore profitable, they created a conservancy, which means basically a place where you find wild animals and then tourists pay to go there to look at the animals and to stay there. And we are talking about very, very rich tourists. There are different of these private conservancies all around this area. And of course, the pastoralists are banned from entering those areas. But this is not the end of the story. So we have a context where there is very little land available, problems with the rain because of climate change. And on top of that, the Craig family, Ian Craig in particular, decided to create an organization. The name is Northern Rangeland Trust, or NRT, as we call it. And this organization is a kind of NGO that advises the pastoralist communities about conservation matters, and in particularly support the creation of these conservancies that we know they exist in their on their lands. So the idea, it sounds very good on paper. They said, look, we help communities to set aside land for conservation, so then they can, tourists will come and then they will receive money. But what happened in reality is that many of these communities do not want to stop grazing on their lands. They are pastoralists. They want to keep grazing. And they are forced to stop grazing because this organization called NRT have also hired park rangers that don't allow the pastoralists to graze anymore. And on top of this, so we have this perfect setup of colonial conservation. So white settlers and other conservation organizations are from outside are telling the pastoralists, you are ruining the environment. We are going to explain you how to do your job. We are going to help you and actually destroying their way of life. But on top of that, we have the carbon credits market, because the last idea of NRT is that because the pastoralists are the ones to blame for the environmental destruction, because they are overgrazing and are destroying the soils. So if we explain them how to graze, so if we explain these pastoralists who have been living here for generations how to graze, they will stop destroying the soil. From the soil, the grass will grow, and this grass will absorb carbon. And so this extra carbon that wouldn't exist without this great project is being sold in the markets. What we have shown is basically the entire model of this model of conservation is based on land theft, first of all, but second, on a racist idea. The idea that the pastoralist people who have been living in these areas for generations are not able to know how to graze their own livestock. And they need NRT to explain them how to graze livestock. We have shown through evidence that we explain in our report that there is no actually data available to show us that actually this project is increasing the capacity of the soil to absorb carbon. So it's just basically based on some mythological idea, and it's actually not working. But if these ideas that I am explaining about are surreal and are actually not having any real impact, the emissions on the other side that companies who buy this carbon credit, these emissions that companies are actually releasing into atmosphere are real. And companies like Netflix or Meta, who are buying these carbon credits produced by this kind of mythological project, they are indeed claiming in their websites that they want to achieve net zero targets, and they hope to do it very soon. So for us, this example shows everything that is wrong in the conservation project that are the more and more, as I say, common. First of all, they are based on the land of people that haven't contributed at all to climate change, or they are the least responsible for it. And they're based on projects that happen on their land without the consent of the people. Many Borana, many Samburu, many Rendile people don't even know what a carbon credit is. They don't even know that they are being that their lands are being used to create profit for other people, and they don't even get much money from it. If they do get something at all, these benefits are really a small portion of what NRT is making or the carbon traders are making. So I think that this is one of the things. So there is no consent. It shows clearly many of these carbon credit projects are happening in this way, are happening on the land of indigenous people without their consent. But it shows also, and this is why I find this example particularly important, that these kind of false solutions are not working. That we are relying, most of the political solutions or political speeches about carbon credits, and we saw it, about climate, and we saw it in the COP28, are around the fact that we don't need to change anything at all of our way of life, that it's just simply as buying a carbon credit somewhere else. So we have to combat these false solutions, first, because they are damaging the people who are least responsible for climate change, but second, because they are not mitigating or helping at all to combat climate change. On the opposite, they're giving us the illusion that we are doing something, and actually nothing is happening.
This is your host, Steve Taylor, and we will be back right after this.
Many of you are probably relieved to see 2023 sink into the oil barrel of history. So we have an idea. Start the new year with Portraits of Struggle. On this, our 20th anniversary, Global Justice Ecology Project is excited to announce the release of a stunning new photography book, Portraits of Struggle, by GJEP co-founder, photojournalist, and documentary photographer Oren Langell. Portraits of Struggle highlights Oren Langell's captivating images documenting interconnected global struggles for environmental, social, and economic justice, spanning 5 decades and 6 continents. Start the new year with Portraits of Struggle, available for 2024. For further information, please go to portraitsofstruggle.org.
Welcome back to Breaking Green. Yes, it was amazing to read the report, and we're going to put, if it's okay with Survival International, we want to put a link on our website and in our show notes so people can read it themselves.
Yeah.
But it was amazing that, there's this carbon trading scheme, and it's based on the idea that these people who have been grazing their animals for centuries are now going to be told how to do it better, to not degrade the land. And there's no empirical evidence that they've been able to do so. Actually, I think there's some evidence that the way they were doing it originally was better. And this is done for the benefit of, these large corporations in the global north, so they can continue, and actually we in the north can continue to have our lifestyles. So all we're asking now is that these indigenous people change everything about their life, right? So they have to change everything based upon, I don't know, weak science and a profit scheme for the Kenyan government and Meta and Netflix. It's outrageous.
Yes, it is, but it's not surprising. If we look into the history of the conservation industry, we see that WWF has never been pointing out that the real cause of environmental destruction is the emissions of Total or Shell or the pollution of Coca-Cola. On the opposite, if we look at who is the president today of WWF, we see that it is this ex-CEO of Coca-Cola. And in the 80s, it was the ex-CEO of Shell. So we see that the conservation industry, so I'm talking about the big conservation organizations that are making millions of dollars or billions of dollars with this idea that they are protecting nature, they have always been linked with the elites of the capitalist system. Half of their CEOs and their their governance bodies, like the trustees and administrators, come from the finance sector. So we are seeing a link, enormous link, between this conservation industry and the most polluting companies in the world. So it's not really a surprise that what they find as a problem, as a kind of cause of environmental destruction, is not the industries itself themselves, but it is indigenous peoples. We have seen it in survival once again. In the Congo Basin, WWF is blaming indigenous hunter-gatherers for the destruction of the forest, while the logging companies can just completely enter the forest and cut trees without anything, any word, and the total silence of WWF. On the opposite, WWF is trying to convert the hunter-gatherers to farmers, so they stop hunting and using the forest. We have seen also with WCS in many other projects. We recently have been in Cambodia and Thailand, and we see it's exactly the same for the farmers. They are being pushed out from their lands in the name of conservation and climate mitigation by Conservation International, or WCS. So it's all around the world the same. It's like these big conservation organizations don't say absolutely anything about the big corporations that are destroying our planet, and then they take as an easy target indigenous people. I find it, as I say, not surprising if we look at it in the history. So I think it's outrageous, but it is not surprising. What we really need to do is to understand that if we want to protect nature, if we want to reduce emissions, we cannot trust the conservation organizations to tell us what is good to do this. What we can see is scientific evidence. We can go on the ground, we can read books, academic papers, and we see it clear. Indigenous peoples are the best guardians of the natural world. The environments where they live were not empty, and it's not like by chance or completely miracle there are the most biodiverse places in the world. They have shaped those environments. The way they interact with nature is not just a way to take from nature, but it's enrich nature, it's nourish nature. So I think we have to change perspective, and it's an invite also to the people that are listening to us to try to reflect more critically into the story of conservation and the links that actually they have. And today, this is not part of the history. So the link conservation had in the past with colonialism, of course, but the link it has today with capitalism.
Yes, that was a large part of our previous segment, and it was a very illuminating one. And the notion, colonial notion of wilderness and setting aside land and pretending that there were no people there, when actually that land had been shaped by relationships with the indigenous people and cultures that were there. So there's a lot built into this with the WWF and now with carbon trading, this notion that I think you said something that it's often said that humanity is at war with nature. And that's just not the case. Some of our capitalists, our technological or industrial ways of life and systems are, but not people. People are not inherently antithetical to nature.
No, not at all, but not my experience. I have spent years of my life with people who don't see nature as something to trade in the market. Nature is not a commodity for mostly of the people I know, and it is something sacred. Of course, they use things provided by nature to live, but there is a respect, there is the idea of reciprocity, there is the idea of sustainability, that they were not waiting for us to invent it, the idea of sustainable development in Rio in 1992. They knew exactly what sustainable meant before. There is a large part of humanity that don't live like we do, and they are not destroying the environment as we do, or companies or governments do. And I think it's dangerous to try to portray this generalistic idea of humanity as humanity is bad, humanity is destroying. I think it's just a way to call out the real accountable, like the people accountable here. It's easy to say humanity is bad, so we just need to separate nature from humanity. But this is just false. And it's not just false, it's dangerous, because what other alternative there is if humanity is not involved? And who is deciding which humanity is okay and which humanity is not okay and which spaces are going to be empty? We have to remember that the most biodiverse places in the world are full of people. That the images we have of the African safari, where we only see wild animals, are a colonial invention. They have been portrayed in that way on purpose. And they have been, the people that have been there have been invisible to the eyes of these documentaries or filmmakers or photographers. There are people living in those places. The savannas of Africa are not empty. The forests of the world are not empty. And it's not just the fact that there are people there, it's that we have so much to learn from those people. So saying that one part of that humanity is evil is actually taking from us the possibility of an alternative. There is an alternative in which humanity is still in the picture. And that alternative is being given to us by many farmers, fishermen, indigenous and non-indigenous, hunter-gatherers all around the world.
Well, another thing that your report highlights is the legality of all of this. I mean, how can this land be taken? It seems to be just against human rights, indigenous rights. There's got to be some international protections and international law against just taking people's land. And it almost seems like a bit of disaster capitalism going on here, an opportunity. I mean, since we have this climate crisis mostly created by the global north and this overconsumption, but now there's a disaster, there's an urgency. So we're going to be able to take and place into these schemes and into the market. Just monetize these lands and remove indigenous people and change those cultures. So what about the legality of all of this?
Yeah, well, it's not just illegal. It's also paid by your taxpayer money. And I think this is something people have to know, that these things are not just illegal from a Kenyan perspective or the perspective of any of national government. This is also would be also illegal if we follow the money and we understand that it is USAID or the German corporation that are actually funding this kind of project. And human rights are we claim that human rights are a very big issue in our own countries. So how this is possible? And I think that the reason is that many people, including many politicians and functionaries, a public servant, don't really know what they're funding. They just give money to conservation because conservation is a good thing, right? We are just protecting a couple of trees or protecting a forest. And I think the problem is that they don't really realize what conservation really means on the ground. They have never been there. They only see nature mainly through internet and TVs and films. And there is a huge misconception on what actually nature is and what's going on in those places. Plus, the big conservation organizations have a very huge power of lobby. WWF is one of the organizations that have spent much more money in lobbying in Brussels, for example. So many, and also many of these conservationists are or were politicians. There is a revolving doors phenomena in the conservation industry too. We have presidents of conservation organizations that were before ministers or were part of a government or were MEPs. So it's almost the same people. So they don't really see the problem. They grew up with this ideology that make them think that conservation is a good thing and nothing is bad. So why create specific laws for this if there is nothing bad in protecting a forest? These things are changing, of course, because we have been campaigning for a long time together with many indigenous and non-indigenous organizations. And today there is much more awareness at the point that the House of Representatives in the U.S. have came up with a bill that would prevent U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is one of the main agencies funding conservation projects abroad, to fund projects of conservation that violate human rights. It seems obvious, But it isn't, because as I said, for many people, there are no people living there. So why we should even link human rights with conservation? Conservation is something to do with animals and plants. So I think that we need to change. It's not just about the legality. It's about changing the paradigm. It's changing the way people think, because there won't be laws if people keep thinking that their forests are empty, nobody lives in the Amazon, nobody lives in the Congo Basin. I think that we need to shift that before. And then, yes, of course, from a indigenous people's perspective, there are many laws, declarations, and conventions that protect their rights. But as I said, it's easy to point out the African governments who are not respecting the rights of these people. When we see where the money comes, we must realize that the people that are committing actually illegal atrocities are Western funders.
Well, it is different when you see some things on the ground. I know that Global Justice Ecology Project, including myself, spent some time in Brazil recently in the Cerrado biome and looked at how the eucalyptus plantations were disrupting life for traditional communities and indigenous people. And at the same time, the Biden administration was announcing that it was going to help fund certain efforts to increase those plantations, but they were talking about planting trees and how that would help, in their opinion, mitigate global warming. But you can't, you know, there's these ideas that people hear, and it sounds good on the surface, but there are actual ramifications. It's like we are looking for these magic bullets to we've abused nature for so long. Now we want to somehow just use it again in just a slightly different way and put it in the ledger as a carbon credit. But when you look into these things, it's just more manipulation, more commodification and abuse of our natural systems, and even more so than that, these indigenous cultures. It's very sad. So last time we talked about this was before COP27, I believe, or during COP27. Now we're at COP28, and there's more of it. What do you think? Is this getting worse from COP to COP? Do you see any hope in the future? What do you think the trend is with this?
Well, of course, at the COPs, the situation is very depressing because it's about governments and carbon traders and other kind of polluting companies. And now the fossil fuel industry being in the Emirates, and the president of the COP is also the president of the oil company of the country. So, of course, it's depressing to see what's happening. But it also gives us the idea that it's not our governments who are going to solve this problem. That if we need civil social action, we need the civil society to do something about it. We cannot sit down and hope that our governments are going magically to become something different of what they are. I have to say the COP28 is particularly depressing because of the context of what is happening. But I think that it's not so depressing when we put it in a bigger picture, in the sense that if we put too much hope in these COPs, yes, of course, it's depressing. But why we should be surprised that this is happening? This nothing better happening in COP27 or COP26. So I think that we should stop putting thinking that magically the governments and the conservation industry and the polluting companies are going to change their mind, and we have to start ourselves to do something about it. But when I say something about it, I don't think that the only thing we should do is going out to the street and demand on governments to tackle climate crisis. Because the way they're going to tackle it is completely embedded in this colonial and racist and neoliberal ideas. We have to start calling the things by their name. We cannot just stop, go around and say, oh, stop climate crisis, stop, do something about climate change. We should be and I think this is a call also for many NGOs who are just out there saying, we need to phase out fossil fuels. Yes, we understand that, but we need to have better proposals, to be able to take a much more leading role in which this government should be doing or not should be doing, but also for ourselves. I don't think we can really expect to tackle the climate crisis if we don't change our way of life. I don't think the climate crisis is a separate issue from any other issue we are facing today. Racism, inequality, social classes problem, all of that is absolutely interlinked. And we cannot solve the climate crisis if we don't solve social justice issues. They are linked. They are interlinked. So I separate the things and just think that this is a good strategy from a communication perspective is a mistake. I'm not really pessimistic because I see around the world many indigenous people and other local communities that they are now taking into court the government. They are now fighting back. They are now saying we are not going to have a better world if we don't have our land. That they are actually the ones leading this much better than anyone else in the Western world, where many of our activists, unfortunately, keep repeating in public speaking that these things, climate change is the biggest threat to humanity, so we need to focus on that, and then we will think about inequality and we will think about racism. This is something that's very common. Many climate activists are like this and repeating this model and saying, well, climate crisis is the biggest threat to humanity. The biggest threat to humanity is not just climate change. It's also this capitalist system in which we are consuming and destroying our nature and the nature of some other people. We cannot tackle this and the economic and social roots of this problem. We are not going to solve it. And I think we have a huge responsibility in the Western world because we are the ones with the funds and the resources and all that other thing. So we are the ones who have much more visibility. And we should be saying this very, very open. And I think that if we look what is happening today on the ground, like the Maasai are suing the government of Tanzania, winning cases and getting their land back, the Ogiek, they're evicted, but they won the case in the African court. If we see the examples of indigenous people who are not giving up, I think that gives us hope. And as I said, I don't have hope that the COP28 will solve anything, but I have hope on our indigenous partners and our indigenous friends and the many other people that are resisting today.
Wow. And it's so easy to ask other people to change, and to do change yourself is so hard. So it looks to me like what I hear you saying is we need to change here in the Western world, in these overdeveloped societies, let's say, and allow the leaders in the world when it comes to climate, who are the indigenous people, because that's the lands where the biodiversity is and they're doing everything right. Let them be and recognize their rights and let's learn from them.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I meant. All the things I said, but this was the right, specifically simple and right thing to say. Just we have to learn from them. And of course, that doesn't mean that we don't have to do anything and we just have to clap them. It means that we have to take a proactive role in dismantling our own structure, social and economical structure that in own society are causing the problems.
Fiore Longo, thank you for joining us at Breaking Green.
Thank you very much for the invitation. As last time, this was great, and it was very interesting also for me.
You have been listening to Breaking Green, a Global Justice Ecology Project podcast. To learn more about Global Justice Ecology Project, visit globaljusticeecology.org. Breaking Green is made possible by tax-deductible donations by people like you. Please help us lift up the voices of those working to protect forests, defend human rights, and expose false solutions. Simply text GIVE, G-I-V-E, to 1-716-257-4187. That's 1-716-257-4187. 4187.